Yeah, it's time to parlay, time to win a little money. Deegan and Juice with Kylan and Stucky. I know you got a chalk, but it's time for the teaser. This is how we do it when it's football season. Ayy, Kylan and Stucky, yeah. Ayy, Kylan and Stucky, woo.
What's up, Degenerate Nation? Welcome to Degen and Juice, episode 36. I'm Stucky, and with me, as always, is Colin Wilson. We had a little bit of a hiatus, as we will during the summer until college football picks back up, but we will do these sporadically in the interim. We were up in New York as a company for an Action Network offsite. Really productive and fun time meeting everyone, putting faces to names of everyone you see writing on the site. One of the people that we met was the one and only Matt Moore. Most of you probably follow him at HP Basketball. Probably one of the only people that tweets as much as I do. What's going on, Matt?
Not much. How are you guys?
Good, good. Colin, how are you?
I'm good. I'm anxious like a sailor because college football win totals are coming out. You know, I'm like a sailor that wants to get to port because I've just got so much to bet. I'm just so excited that it's almost our time of year.
We will get there. First, we have more pressing needs, and that's to cover – well, first, the NHL playoffs are going on, and they're amazing right now. The round two matchups are awesome. But we're going to first talk about the NBA with Matt. Now, Matt, do you want to just give a quick background of how you got into the NBA? Do you have a team and, you know, your favorite player? Just a little quick background of yourself.
Yeah, I started loving the NBA when I was a kid. Like, it was Alonzo Mourning for me, which shows you how I'm used to losing because he was always getting his ass kicked by Shaq. Loved him with those Hornets teams, that Larry Johnson, Alonzo Mourning, Muggsy Bogues team. And then I really kind of kicked up into higher gear when I love that Rockets team with Elijah Wan and all the shooters. I just love the mechanics of, like, this Houston team beating a New York team and forcing the double in the post and then kicking out to shooters. So that really got me into it. And then after college, I was working in Austin, Texas, and I was actually running poker in bars and restaurants, and I needed a hobby on the side. And so I started a blog, and it took off. And I eventually started doing this professionally because that's how the internet used to work, is you just start doing something and you have to do it. And I've been covering the NBA professionally for 10 years, and it's, to me, the most entertaining sport to watch.
Now, do you have a favorite team? Like, or is it just really depend on that era or a certain period of time?
So, like, when I started blogging, I was like, well, I need a team. I need to pick one because I used to just like everybody. And a lot of NBA fans just kind of like the league in general. But I was like, well, I need a team. So I was like, I need a team that's never going to be good. That's never, ever going to be good so that I'm never, like, compromised in talking about them in any sort of relevant series. I was like, oh, I'll take Memphis. Like, I'm from Arkansas. They're the closest team. They're going to be terrible forever. They'll never be good. I'll take Memphis. And then immediately Memphis became like a perennial 50-win team that didn't win the title and only made the conference finals once, but consistently won games. So it was like a total fail there. Honestly, at this point, I've been doing this for long enough that it kind of gets bled out of you. Like, I get paid either way, right? So I don't necessarily lean in any sort of one direction. I have a soft spot in my heart for Memphis for sure, though.
Fair enough. Yeah, speaking of Larry Johnson, I mean, one of the plays that I'll never forget that most NBA fans will remember is that four-point play in, what, late 90s or early 2000s with the Knicks. And I remember I was a big fan of Larry Johnson, too. I was in something called the L Club or something. I mean, I was like 15, and I would get – they would – send, like, it was like a Larry Johnson fan club. I don't know how I joined this, but I would get like posters and things in the mail of Larry Johnson. So we have similar ties there.
Larry Johnson was the most hated player in all of Arkansas history because of his time at UNLV and how Todd Day took a swing at him. And like, yeah, I mean, it goes way back in Arkansas.
Yeah, I took a lot of beef from that from my friends back in Arkansas. That's one of it. But I may have for it by always talk about how great Carlos Williamson was both in college and in the NBA. And he's been a great long-term assistant as well.
There, so let's get Colin.
Oh, I was just going to say it's a huge contrast to Scottie Thurman, who came out early just like Corliss, and he's done nothing but sit on the Razorback bench and serve water to Mike Anderson. So
yeah.
All right, so let's get into the – and I'll make sure I don't take too many digs at Arkansas since I'm outnumbered here. But let's get into go series by series. Now, we're recording this Wednesday afternoon. There's only one NBA game tonight, Rockets-Jazz, so we won't spend too much time on this game and or series since the game two result will be – over tonight, and then there'll be adjusted series prices and game three lines. But is there any chance the Jazz have any chance here, or is this done and dusted?
I think that watching the line when it shifts back to Houston, or back to Utah rather, is going to be really interesting. I don't think they're done. One, very quietly under the radar, Rubio was upgraded today. And that to me is a kind of an indication of if he comes back early, this whole series can kind of shift, at least in terms of how close Utah can keep it. Houston's also going to be good for one complete garbage game shooting from three at some point. Like, that's going to happen. It could be tonight. It could be game three. It could be, like, at some point, they're going to shoot like 25% from three, and Utah is going to have a chance to either to win or be very, very close to winning. So I don't think it's over. I think the series is decided, and that I don't see any scenario where Utah is able to collect four wins versus them. But I do think that it's not necessarily going to be a runaway just because of how dominant the Rockets were in game one.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm looking at, and tell me if you agree or not, since I'm, you know, a novice when it comes to the NBA, is if, you know, the Warriors won comfortably in both games. I know that the Pelicans covered last night, but if the Rockets win, you know, relatively comfortably tonight, then I'm definitely going to look at the Pels plus four. I think that's the line for game three. And then the Jazz game three at home. I think you get their best efforts in both. Is that dumb, or would you tend to agree?
I don't like Pels plus four. That's too tight. Like the problem is Curry increases this variance where Curry can have a stretch where he just absolutely goes off. And when they start clicking like that, they go on runs where they make 10-point games into 25 in a span of like 3 minutes. And I don't trust New Orleans to be able to focus on everything that they have to. Like, they played really well last night and hung in a long time, and the Warriors still pulled away towards the end. I think that fourth, I think, is too tight. I do like looking at what Utah is going to be. Like, if Utah winds up somewhere, you know, if Utah ends up at, I don't imagine they'll be any greater than four, but if they wind up somewhere like five or six, then I would be very much into Utah plus that number.
It's worth noting. Yeah. It's also worth noting too that, like, Curry had no rust on him whatsoever last night. I mean, he's come back from injury before, and you could tell in the games that he just wasn't better in transition. His shot was off. He looked fantastic the second he came off the bench.
Yeah, it's go ahead, Matt.
Well, I just think that a lot of it with him is he freaks out the defense so much. Like, they just get terrified of whenever he crosses half court, because when he does stuff last night, like where he drops the ball and dribbles it, and it's like, it's terrible basketball. It really genuinely is terrible basketball. When he's just like, up, I dropped the ball and I fumbled it, and up, I'm going to vomit it up from 35 feet and it goes in because he's the best shooter ever. It's terrible basketball, but when that happens to you, it starts to break down you start to break down mentally. Like, I've talked to guys about it, about how there's nobody else that panics a team the way that he does. LeBron's this freight train, but at least you see him coming. And with Curry, it's like, you're always looking out. You're trying to dodge bullets in this battlefield, and you don't know where they're coming from. It just creates a whole sense of panic. And New Orleans, I think, has done a really good job defensively over the course of the season. They have a lot of things going their way. But the reality is we saw in game one that whenever the Warriors ran guys off of curls, that their defense freaked out and tried to cover those shots, and then they let things get to the rim. They did a little bit better job of that in game two, but I think that's probably going to shift back in game three. The Warriors are able to get whatever they want, and that's going to be the issue, is New Orleans has to shoot improbably well for them to hang in this series.
Yeah, I think that both teams shot 13 of 40 from three, and yeah, New Orleans has to outshoot the Warriors from three, which is not easy to do. And yeah, you're right about the betting against the Warriors is so scary, because you could be up 17 catching nine in the first half and it doesn't matter,
right?
You know, it's stunning. So is that a sweep?
I think it is. I think that Golden State got mad at everyone thinking that they could lose. No one said they were going to. People just said, you know, they've got some weaknesses, because you try and generate some sort of drama, and they took that as disrespect, because that's what they do. I don't think that New Orleans has enough offense to be able to generate it. Part of it is, like, if they had Cousins, they could really grind this down and just obliterate them with post-ups and draw a lot of fouls, and they can't do that without Cousins. And their defense is playing so well. A lot of it's like, if Iguodala was looking rustier, if he was more banged up, they might have a chance. But when Iguodala's playing as well as he has, that makes it really tough. I think it's a sweep.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we couldn't see Boogie for this series, because that would have made it a lot more interesting. Okay, so before we get to Cavs-Raptors, just crossing off Rockets-Jazz. The Jazz got here by beating the Thunder. So two-part question. Scale of 1 to 10, how shocked were you with the result and how that series played out? And what do you make of, you know, the Thunder's future?
I was not shocked at all that the OKC lost. I was mildly shocked that they really should have lost in five. That was shocking to me. That I would say that was about like a 7, that they were that outmatched. OKC is in a bad place. I'm not as worried as some people are because I've seen Sam Presti pull rabbits out of hats enough. Presti's really smart. He operates under cover of darkness. You never hear who he's targeting. And he goes and he gets big name acquisitions. Like, he's done it consistently throughout his time with Oklahoma City. He drafts well. He knows how to leverage his assets. And he's able to find his way out of things. But like, if Paul George leaves and Melo opts in, they're cap strapped with what is realistically like a 35 win team. And that's absolutely catastrophic. They can draft somebody and get a little bit better if they can find a way to get into the pick range. But I think that they'll probably figure out something. I'm also not sold that George is gone. Like, I still think Oklahoma City thought Durant was staying, but there was a real sense of panic. I talked to somebody close to their organization this week, and he said, look, we thought we would keep KD because it was inconceivable to us that we would have the amount of success that we would have and that he would leave that. But there were signs all along the way. Like, he started disconnecting in early that year in January. Like, there were starting to be signs that were worrisome, but we were just like, well, he's just going through the process and he'll be fine. And so there was worry, but it was just inconceivable that it could happen. So when he left, it was devastating. What he said about this year, though, he said, George was different in that we really feel like he has actual, like, he genuinely loves playing here. He really likes playing with Russell. He thinks this team can seriously win. And having come from Indiana, having a front office that has invested as much in its players really means a lot to him. It doesn't mean that he can't go, because if he just decides he wants to go to L.A., he's going to go to L.A. But I continue to look at the Lakers and not think that they're going to be as big of a threat as people kind of make them out to be. So if George stays, they can definitely be fine. And there's a chance that Mel opts out because he's just that miserable. But the most likely scenario is that he opts in and then they have to buy him out. And Bennett just pays through the teeth, which he hates doing, but will do it this one time. And Melo goes to like Miami or Houston.
His analysis on Carmelo on Twitter, you know, about he wanted a max contract in a big city in the big market. And I laugh at that every time I think about Carmelo hanging around Bricktown. I mean, there's only so many places to eat. There's no celebrities there. It's just not a good fit for him whatsoever. I can see him opting out because it's just such a bad fit.
But the thing you have to remember is this, is one, Melo has always wanted everything. That was my central point. He wants everything. He wants to be the star player on a loaded championship team in a big market. That was his dream. And when it didn't happen, he like dealt with the reality of New York. But that's still what he thinks of himself as. And the other thing is, you know, he has consistently opted for the money. And I want to make it clear, like, I don't blame the man at all. He literally came from a place called Murder Avenue in Baltimore. That's where Melo grew up. That guy has poured millions of dollars into a youth center in Baltimore's worst area. He has committed a huge amount to trying to help people, but also, like, because you come from those circumstances, that dude is like, I'm getting mine. I am getting mine. So that mine and every kid that comes from my bloodline is never going to have to deal with those kind of conditions again. So I don't blame him, but that has always driven his decision. In Denver, he could have waited and just left as a free agent. And everyone says, like, oh, he wanted to help Denver out with a trade. That is a lie. He did not care about Denver. What he cared about was getting the max extension, which paid him more money than he would have made as a free agent. So he demanded that extension before he got traded as a mechanism to get more money. He had an opportunity to leave New York and go to Chicago or Houston a couple of years ago. He turned down better opportunities because of the money. So I can't see him leaving $28 million on the table when he knows if he opts in, and it's so bad, he can opt in and make it miserable for them, and they'll pay him out because that's what teams do, and that's exactly what Dwayne Wade, a good buddy of his, did. I agree with you. He's not going to want to hang around OKC in a situation where he's not comfortable with the offense and doesn't like it. I agree with you. He's not going to want to stay in Oklahoma, but right. I do think that he knows that there's a path for him to get the money and get out, and that's what he'll be after.
Good yeah, stuff. I can't see him not taking the money. And if you think about it, it's – during the NBA season, you're either playing games half in half the year, or you're on the road half the year, and then once the season ends, he's out of OKC, and you know, it's just 1 year. I can't see that being a deterrent. But you had high praises for Presti. What did he see in that move?
What do you mean?
In bringing Melo into OKC.
Oh, I think for a lot of it, like, Melo was kind of underrated by this point last summer, and the idea was always he could be Olympic Melo, that if you put him on the right team and he accepted his role, that he could thrive. And what was funny was he did. Like, he actually didn't dominate the ball and didn't try and ISO too much and really did become a spot-up shooter. He just sucked at it. Like, he's just 2 years too late. It's just too late on him. And when Presti made that move, the other thing to consider is, like, Presti made that move and all he gave up was Cantor. Like, he gave up a bad player you couldn't play in the playoffs anyway for a bad player you can't play in the playoffs anyway. Like, there was really no loss in what he gave up to New York. There wasn't a whole lot of things that they gave up in that scenario. It was a buy-low situation. And the other thing that people miss is Presti did most of what he did not just to be able to add a team that could contend, but he did it to be able to show Russell Westbrook, we will constantly put great players around you. We will not waste your prime. And that was part of what got Westbrook's name on his signature for that huge extension. The money was part of it, sure. But a lot of it was, you know, Russell could make more if he was in LA with the kind of sponsorship and business opportunities he would have there. But he wanted to be in Oklahoma City. But he wanted to be in Oklahoma City if they could prove to him we're always going to contend. And even if, no matter what people, like, we think of Melo, Westbrook thinks very highly of Melo. And getting him was a huge plus for the organization and helped get his name on that so that Oklahoma City's not left without no KD, no Harden, no Westbrook, because that cost Sam Presti his job.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, never looked at it like that, but that makes sense. So let me get to the next series, and this is probably one of the more intriguing series that's going on right now. And I had the Raptors money line last night in a parlay. I still don't know how I lost it. They never trailed in regulation. I don't know how they missed. They missed every shot in the fourth quarter and then every layup in the final seconds. Tell me how they lost that game, and tell me why I shouldn't bet the -6.5 in game two, Matt. But
try having under 200, 213 when, you know, 105-105 tie. I mean, it was brutal last night.
God, Moose's antlers just shoved up your ass. Jesus. so I think I would tell you that I love the Raptors' money line in game two. 6.5 is a little high, but I still feel way more confident in Raptors -6.5 than I do about Cavs +6.5. Toronto lost that game because guys missed shots.
Wide open shots, right?
I say this as a guy that does X's and O's breakdowns and analytics and looks at their metrics and the coaches and their strategies and lineups. I dig as deep as anybody in the league does, obsessively trying to understand this stuff. I study what coaches say, player quotes, everything that I can get my hands on. I talk to other GMs and coaches about these teams. I say this in all honesty. The Raptors generated great looks. They got the looks they wanted. The Cavs defense is still garbage. Guys missed shots. And the narrative today is that they choked, and I don't mind that because that's part of sports, right? Like, the narrative today is just, oh, same old Raptors, they choked. The Raptors in previous years would have choked this away by DeMar DeRozan chucking up contested twos falling away versus a double team. It's not what happened. DeRozan played brilliantly in that fourth quarter. He got open looks for other guys consistently. That Jonas Valanciunas sequence where he missed three bunnies, that dude is going to hit that shot almost every single time. He has been great in that scenario this year. And maybe it was nerves, maybe it was whatever. I tend to think it was more the ball just did not go in the damn hole. So really what it comes down to is Toronto lost a game that it should have won. And the response to that has also been, well, look, they just lost a game in which LeBron played absolutely terribly. They didn't shoot well from three. And the Raptors still lost. So what does that say about the rest of the series? The problem is I have no confidence in Cleveland playing well again. They got a huge Jeff Green game. Any game where Jeff Green goes off, we're in Twilight Zone weirdo territory. I think there's a lot of reasons to believe that Toronto is going to be fine. You just have to kind of – but here's the problem. It's like if they lose game two, it's done. It's over. The Raptors will be broken. The biggest problem that the Raptors have right now is an entirely mental thing. And I say this as a guy, again, I focus on X's and O's and analytics, but there is a very mental thing here where the quotes out of today of Toronto are exactly what you want to hear from them. But if they lose game two, their confidence is going to be absolutely shattered and they will have no way to get back.
So Chip, would you recommend, because I've been staring all day at, and I'm just afraid of the mental aspect too, but I've been staring all day at Raptors +115 for the series. That looks like the side, right?
Yeah, that's the side I would be on. Like, they're a better team, and a lot of it just comes down to you're not betting on Toronto. You're fading the Cavaliers, which sounds insane because you're like, I can't fade LeBron. That's how bad this team is. This team is worth fading. They do not play. They are a terrible defensive team. They are an inconsistent offensive team. A bunch of their guys are unproven. Like, Jordan Clarkson's a mess right now. Larry Nance can't get off the bench. They're relying on Tristan Thompson right now. Tristan Thompson and Kyle Korver are their second and third best players. That alone, if you're getting plus money to fade them, that's the side.
Yep. I completely agree.
It's a heck of a series change in price, though, because, I mean, it was over minus 200 for the Raptors, and you have one game, and you're down to plus 115 when you know this is going to go back and forth. So it's pretty drastic change in the market.
I think a lot of it is that they just assume, well, Cleveland's got home court now. I think that's a big shift of it. It's like they stole home court, but Cleveland lost game one in Cleveland. Like, they are not invulnerable at home. They're not a great home team. They're not a great road team. They're not a great team, period. So, like, I don't think Toronto is going to have any sort of issue going into game three or game four and winning that. Like, right now, I would say that I expect Toronto to win games two and three, and then game four and five are where it gets real serious, and that's going to decide the series. It's entirely possible that this is just one of those things where life is just like, nope, the Raptors will never beat LeBron. It's just never going to happen. No matter what has to occur, that's what is going to happen. But right now, from a logical standpoint, I can, and after watching again the clips this morning, the Raptors made turnovers, and that, if you want to say, was part of the choke, is definitely, I think, something to talk about. But a lot of it is just like stuff that they won't do. I just don't believe they'll do again because they haven't done it all year, and they didn't even do it in the first round. They'll clean up the turnovers. They'll shoot better from three. I like Toronto in two and three.
Yeah, the way I see it, I mean, there were so many wide open shots. It was unbelievable. But the way I see it playing out, I tend to agree with you. I think Toronto wins game two. I think they split in Cleveland, win game five, and then I think, like, LeBron has an absurd game six, doesn't let the Cavs lose in Cleveland, and then Toronto rolls in game seven. That's how I see it playing out anyway.
Yeah, I still like Raptors in six, but if I was going for any of the futures right now, I would be looking at Raptors in seven, just because I think sticking with Raptors winning in Cleveland to win the series and close LeBron out feels perilous. So that's part of my concern there. But I think Raptors in six and Raptors in seven still look really good.
Yeah. Okay. The other series in the East, before we touch on futures here, Sixers-Celtics. It was nice to finally, this final broke the streak of 18 straight favorites winning in the NBA playoffs. So it was nice to see a dog. Pretty surprising result. I mean, that line moved up to four. You had the Celtics coming off a game seven win and a quick turnaround. But sometimes, you know, you can stay in rhythm in that scenario. They won pretty easily over the Sixers. Sixers minus four again in game two. I mean, it's amazing what the Celtics are doing. Brad Stevens is a god. What are your thoughts on game two and the series and what happened in game one?
I really like Philly here. I think the Sixers definitely, I think, bought into the hype that they played that game like a team that had been listening to how awesome they were for 10 days. Embiid in particular came out just lazy as hell. And I think getting smacked in the mouth by Boston is actually a really good thing. Like, this is going to be an emotional series, and that's an environment where the Sixers are at an advantage because they play with more intensity, they have more athletes, they have a more talented team. On Five Dimes, it's Sixers in six is plus 205. Love that number right now. At plus 205, I really like that number. I think that Philly's chances are excellent in game two because they'll probably make a lot of key adjustments. Boston shot unsustainably well. Philadelphia shot absolutely horribly. There are tactical problems that Boston does present. And Mears and I are working on a thing for tomorrow, talk about the Sixers' weaknesses, both in this series and if they advance. And one of them in particular is that the Heat never really targeted Marco Bellinelli. Like, they just, for whatever reason, I think a lot of it's just like Dragic never has the mindset to go after weaknesses. He's one of the worst guards in the league, in my opinion, in the playoffs at targeting specific matchup problems. Boston will find your weakness and they will hammer it because they have to, because they don't have Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward. So they have to find every single advantage they can. They hunted down Bellinelli. They forced switches onto Horford, and then Horford posted up. They forced switches onto Rozier, and Rozier took him to the rack. They forced switches onto Tatum, and Tatum scored on him. And if Bellinelli cannot play in this series. That takes out a huge chunk of what Philly's success has been over the last 2 months, which has been their three-point shooting. They've been absolutely ballistic from three, really, since Embiid went down with that facial injury. Embiid's going to have to play better in this series for them to win, and if he does that, I think they can absolutely kick the snot out of this team. But this is kind of the key, is like, can Embiid come back and dominate in the way? And will the Sixers trust him? That's going to be a lot of this. They have got to, I hate to fucking say this, but trust the process and give him the ball. I know, but like, give him the ball and just let him absolutely dominate inside and work them over time and time and time again. That's what's got to happen. Because I don't think that their model for how they won without Embiid, with the explosive three-point shooting of Marco Bellinelli and Ersan Ilyasova, I think that was always smoke and mirrors, and Boston figured that out pretty quickly in game one.
Yeah, so maybe Embiid won't be laying down watching Dragon Ball before game two. So, okay. Yeah, I tend to think the Sixers will come back too, but I mean, one of the dumbest things I've bet in the last month was fading the Celtics in game seven, fading Brad Stevens, and you know, that guy in the postseason is nails. But, okay, so from a futures perspective, and then Colin has a couple prop questions, and then we'll let you go. From a futures perspective, the Warriors right now, I believe, are favored, slight favorites, to win it all, minus 115-ish. Are they winning it all again? Is that or are the Rockets have a shot? I just assume no one in the East can compete with the winner coming out of the West. Do you agree with that? And is it just the Warriors title again?
Yeah, I mean, I think 116 is low enough for it to be good value on return. I got them at plus money before the playoffs started because, like, I was just like, no one's beating them. But Rockets at plus 232 is pretty good return. Don't take anybody in the East. None of those teams can match up. Like, there is a scenario I can envision where Cleveland basically bumbles and stumbles and fails its way somehow into the finals, and then Houston knocks off the Warriors, and then the Cavs match up better with Houston, and Houston goes cold. Like, that's a scenario that I can be like, yes, that is a plausible environment I can see. Like, if you get LeBron to where he is in the finals and he's not facing the Warriors, that is going to be enough. That might be enough for him to actually get it done, right? Like, he sees the opportunity. This is his window. He gets to steal a title in a year in which the Warriors did not make the finals. But you have to believe that they're going to be a Raptors team that's better than them, a Sixers team that's better than them, or that Boston beats Philly. And then that Houston will simply go cold because they should beat the snot out of the Cavaliers too. Like, at plus 1275 for Cleveland, okay, yeah, like, the return's awesome. But the one I like probably the best is still Warriors minus 116 because it's so low, or Rockets plus 232.
Yeah, I think I actually like taking the Rockets plus 232 on this premise. They have home court advantage in the Western Conference Finals. So if you think that they're, you know, I think that their best shot at, you know, maybe is game one, right? I mean, the crowd's going to be hype. They come out and they shoot the lights out. And then you come back. So you have the Rockets plus 232, and then you can come back with the Warriors then, who probably would go to a dog. They would definitely go to a dog in the futures market. But that I think that could present, you know, an opportunity to kind of get plus money on both sides. But, yeah, I mean, it looks like – I mean, with the Rockets out there, remember, if they just shoot well and win every home game, they're going to the finals. But that's hard to do against the Warriors. Colin, you've
yeah, I was just going to say – yeah, if you're a guy like me that doesn't have any futures at this point, but you want to get involved in the market, I don't think right now is the best time to buy the Warriors. The way that they've looked against the Pelicans and the fact that they may sweep them, that number is not going to go into the positive. But if they lose game one against the Rockets, and obviously they may get flipped and you may get a positive number out of it. So if you really want to get some money down on the Warriors, I would suggest waiting until they get into that series with the Rockets. So some prop questions that I had. So the real drama for me comes after the season's over, because it feels like Warriors Cavs is everything everyone's been talking about for 4 years. And I think the first thing we've got to talk about is the lottery draft, the picking of the teams of who's going to get the number one pick. Because correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, but I think that this is a loaded class that's going to come into the NBA, as to where next year, and I think even the year after that, are going to be some pretty weak draft classes. So this one's kind of important. The Suns, the Grizz, and the Mavs, and the Hawks all have the best odds to pull the number one pick. But if we believe in the frozen envelope scenario that happened years ago with Ewing, would we not want to lay a little bit of money on Lakers that are 66-1, the Knicks that are 43-1, or possibly even the Bulls that are 15-1? Could we see something crazy like that happen?
No. And the reason, at least for the Lakers, the reason you don't want to is they don't have their pick. So if it goes number one, the Sixers get it. If it goes two through, I think, five, Boston gets it in the trade for Fultz last year. And then if it lands outside of that window, the Sixers get it. The Lakers don't own it. So the Lakers can't get frozen enveloped. The Knicks are interesting from that perspective, but there's not like a singular can't miss team. So like if you could land on a range, if it was like Knicks land top three, that one might be pretty good, because there just continues to be so much consternation and frustration from the league that team is a garbage fire. Like they just cannot stand that the team in the NBA's home city, in the quote-unquote mecca of basketball, this great franchise is so terrible, and because they won't ever realize, like, it's Dolan. Like, if you want to fix this, you're going to have to get rid of ownership. That one I don't think is great. What I tend to start thinking about is the Nets pick, because if the Nets getting the first pick is plus 2815, guess who owns that Nets pick? The Cleveland Cavaliers, who have won the NBA lottery three times in the last 10 years. So based off of their success rate in the lottery with Dan Gilbert's son, who goes every year, that's a pretty high success rate for a pretty random event. There's obviously no reason to ever put money on this random drawing whatsoever, but Brooklyn getting it to me is the most fascinating scenario, because like if the Cavaliers get that pick, then it increases the odds of LeBron staying. And you have to think about it from a league perspective. Do they want them to get that pick so that he stays? Or do they want them to not get that pick, so it's more likely that he goes to L.A. and revitalizes the Lakers? So if you're going into the frozen envelope territory, these are the questions I would be asking myself.
Right. You know, degeneracy, we got to get some money down on this somehow, so that's all good, especially the Nets. That's really great info. But there's also going to be props posted on Kawhi and LeBron and what their landing spots are going to be. So if I had to put you on the spot before the props are posted, what would you say the two or three teams are that are in the Kawhi and then the LeBron sweepstakes this summer?
Both so the money the Warriors.
the money on Kawhi is going to be it's going to be so heavily tilted towards San Antonio, you're not going to get any value on it. I think looking at whatever the Clippers price comes out, the Clippers will probably be the closest plus money. They'll probably be like, you know, depending on what the signals are, it could be anywhere between like plus 300 to plus 800. The Clippers are the one I would look at, because they have assets to send. They can help the Spurs be good now. They do have picks. Like, they have a lot of different things that they can send for Kawhi. And Jerry West is there, and Jerry West does not want to go through a rebuild. So they have the pieces to be able to put things back together. So if they can trade for Kawhi, they can convince DeAndre Jordan to re-sign, and then I guess you have Lou Williams as your third best, but it's not great. Their cap situation is not awesome. But they have some young players. They've got Kawhi. They've got DeAndre Jordan. They're in a big market that pleases the people that are around him. And his circle, like, that's a scenario I could see working out. If you're going to put plus money on something, that's one to look at. The Sixers are the other one. I think Brian Colangelo will make that call, and they do have assets to spare. If the Sixers are some sort of long shot, I would definitely go there, because your money return on that's pretty great. Like, the sense around the league is not, he is definitely going to be back in San Antonio. The sense around the league is like, no one knows how this is going to work out. It's too weird. The big story on ESPN yesterday from Ramona Shelburne, which was phenomenal, as her work always is, along with Michael C. Wright, who's incredible down in San Antonio. A lot of that kind of gives an indication of the Kawhi Leonard is very outrightly trying to present, this is just an injury issue. It's just injuries, and the Spurs are not being fair about it, except for the Spurs are always fair about it. And that's what got people around the league spooked, is they're like, the Spurs are never rushing a player back. Like, they don't do this stuff. If a player says, no, I don't feel right, they're like, okay, sit out. They've never had a problem with this. So there's a definite sense around the league that he could be gone. The heavy money will be on him staying, there will be an opportunity for big ROI, I think, on either the Sixers or the Clippers as two premium teams.
And LeBron, where's he end up?
So what you're probably going to see is the heavy money. You're going to see the Rockets are going to be a minus, I think, on this. Unless they make the finals, the Rockets are going to be favored to get him. There are a lot of reasons for that. There is the sense I get is that there's optimism inside Houston. People around the league, I'll put it this way. People around the league sense optimism in Houston is how I would describe that in terms of their ability to get LeBron. They have a number of ways to pull this off. Having Chris there is really key. If the Rockets lose in the Western Conference Finals to the Warriors, that I think shoots the odds up even greater that he goes there, because it means he can be the missing piece. I wrote about this in a thing before the playoffs started. LeBron's got to go somewhere where he's the missing component to them beating the Warriors, where he needs them and they need him. He can't go somewhere. If Houston beats Golden State, he can't go to Houston, because then he's just bandwagoning on Houston, and that hurts his legacy. There's going to be a lot of push for the Sixers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too, because you could make that – say the Warriors beat the Rockets and then the Sixers in the finals. He could – both of those teams fit both that scenario, right?
Yeah. I'll say this. I don't ever like to say – like, we like to think we know what LeBron's thinking, but the problem is that, like – he does make decisions based off of very personal desires. Like, his only reason for going back to Cleveland was a personal drive to complete a legacy and to return there, and because he missed it that much. And for him to be driven out is a pretty emotional decision, too. Like, he would just default to, like, I just want to stay here. But that's how badly Dan Gilbert has screwed this up, that he's thinking about leaving. My hesitation with the Sixers is this. Star players that have been around, once they're at the age 28, they want to play with like star players of that age or greater. If LeBron goes to Philadelphia, he is the old man. Like, he is the old dude on a team with, like, Ben is like 20 or 21, and Embiid is like 23. Like, all of these young dudes, there is a generational gap between them and him. Let me tell you the story. So, the first season in Cleveland in 2000, when he came back in 2014, I went in the locker room post game, and Kyrie saw something on his phone that was like stupid and silly, one of those stupid internet videos. And he like walks over to LeBron. I was like, you gotta see this. And he shows it to him. And LeBron just like looked at him and goes, huh? And then like, that was it. And it was just like, you could just tell that there are these moments. And I caught this during the finals too, where LeBron would just like roll his eyes at some of the stuff that the younger guys did. And they got older and they formed more of a bond, but he'd be going right back to that if he goes to the Sixers, and that gives me hesitation on going with that side. I think Houston, the Lakers, and the Clippers are three teams that I would look at very closely in the odds.
It's kind of like when you're a younger kid and you think something's funny and you show your dad, and your dad's like, right. Oh, okay, yeah, that's funny. Yeah, they're just not on the same humor level, and yeah, that's a generational gap. That's a fair point. Okay, well, I won't take up too much of your time. If you haven't checked out Matt, I was sure you have, on the Action Network, all of his NBA work is fantastic. Hopefully we can have you on again, Matt, and continue crushing the NBA coverage, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Woo pick Suey.
Thanks, Matt. Woo pick Suey.
Okay, Colin, so before we sign off here, we have some other business to attend to, some football, some derby. So let's start with quickly, we'll just go quick thoughts on the NFL draft. You know, we're going to be getting deep into the NFL and college football towards the end of the summer as football approaches. So, and writing a lot about it, but do want to talk about the draft some. You know, the Ravens draft was really interesting to me. It's Ozzie's last draft, and I really thought they were going to go Ridley or more when both fell at wide receiver, which is a need, but they went tight end instead. The Lamar Jackson is really intriguing. I'm curious to see how he can develop as a passer, but I like both tight ends they got. And Ozzie hasn't, the one thing he hasn't done well is draft wide receivers in the first round. I like some of the wide receivers they got late. You know, the kid out of UCLA, he does, you know, he's kind of immature, but I think he's going into a good locker room for that. And then the kid out of New Mexico State who made that ridiculous catch in the bowl, Jaleel Scott. I think that they have some potential. So I think they had a pretty good draft as usual. But I think the team, in my opinion, that had the best draft was, well, first of all, my favorite first round pick was Derwin James for the Chargers. But they still need to improve. I was sort of surprised with the who they picked, Omwosu from USC at linebacker. Jefferson was available. That's what they really need. If they shore up the middle of their defense, because their rush defense was, you know, an area of weakness last year, but up the gut, how he plays out, I thought that I would have taken some other linebackers, but taking Derwin James on that defense, their pass defense, pass rush is going to be ridiculous. Their futures odds dropped considerably. I'll ask you about that, but the draft that I think, the team that had the best draft, in my opinion, was the Broncos. I think the Broncos did everything right from start to finish. And, you know, they got Chubb, who I love. Mm-hmm. Their pass rush is going to be crazy. Freeman at running back, which was a need for them. And then, you know, they got probably my favorite player going into the draft in Sutton, who I think is going to be an awesome pro. So I really like the Broncos draft from start to finish. What were your kind of big takeaways?
I got to cut you off there because we didn't even talk about this. It's a perfect segue into the notes that I made about the NFL draft is that the team that I was really keyed on was the Oakland Raiders. And the reason is because when the NFL schedule came out, I saw that they were taking three separate East Coast trips and a London trip, and none of these were linked together. I mean, it's seriously four separate trips, and they have to go back to Oakland. So I didn't like their schedule in the first place. I don't like the Chucky hype. I don't like the Gruden hype. They had some internal issues going on with the offensive line last year. There was some real issues about Carr not taking a knee, and there's just some chemistry issues with that team. So I wanted to watch this draft. Two of the first three players selected were offensive tackles. You know, they like to go in that six-man offensive line kind of rotation that they do to try to run the ball. But they have to do that in this division now with Bradley Chubb going to Denver and what the Chargers have on defense is insane. So I feel like Oakland's already playing catch-up. You know, they drafted Arden Key. You know, you and I were big. A year ago, you and I started talking about LSU. All we could talk about was Arden Key, but he never really fully developed. I think there's some immaturity issues with some marijuana and suspensions and sitting out games.
He was hurt some, too. Yeah,
he was hurt, too. And, you know, and I just think there was another draft report that came out that said that Key just hasn't really gotten any bigger or any stronger in his time at LSU. He hasn't really had any much player development since he got there. So, you know, this draft by the Raiders, it really didn't help the outlook that I had on them in the first place. So Westgate opened them their win total at 8. Five Dimes came out at 8.5, and there's just been a flood of money coming in on the over. So I'm sitting here and just waiting for that flood to end. And if anybody wants to pop a 9 on the Raiders, I will more than happily take the under on them. Division odds came out yesterday. The Chargers were +220, and the Raiders were +220 to win the West. And, you know, the Broncos were way off, like +500 something. But that number shocked me a little bit, too. I think the only other takes I got for the NFL draft is people taking the Mayfield Ward thing at the Browns, and that total is now up to 5.5, is just laughable to me. The Packers taking care of their corner issues, I think, is a really big deal. I think that was a real problem for them, and the better they make that defense, the more Aaron Rodgers is going to be on the field, you know, as long as he's healthy. And then I think the other thing about the Chargers I wanted to loop back on was their 7th-round pick was Justin Jackson. And this is a multi-purpose back who never missed a game at Northwestern. He did everything for Northwestern, and all the years that he played for them, he never missed a game. And I think that's going to be just a fantastic addition if he can make the roster to be behind Melvin Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw the Chargers somewhere 25-1. Mm-hmm. They were lower than that at some places. They were 40-1. I think you got them at 40-1 that you tweeted. But the thing that I would say about the Chargers is, you know, that week one they played the Chiefs and they lost 8 games in a row to. They're notoriously slow starters. So I think I may end up diving in some, but I think I might wait on them for, you know, a 1-2 start, maybe after a 1, and then get in the market. But that team is dangerous, especially if they can get off to a good start, starting with getting that Chiefs monkey off their backs. And then the Raiders, the Raiders money is funny because – that was the same storyline last year. Remember, I think it was last year. It might have been the year before, but I think it was last year when the big summer story was all the futures money that came in on the Raiders. And like they mm-hmm. were at one point, they were the favorites to win the Super Bowl at one book. So, you know, it's pretty funny. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a buyer in the Raiders either. And that's just, that's a ridiculous division. Because I think the Broncos are going to be much improved. You know, the Chiefs will be solid. There's, and, then I think the Chargers are really good. So, well, I don't think the Raiders are terrible. I don't think they're good enough to win that division. So I was, I was surprised to also see the Raiders and Chargers have the same price for that division. But we'll get into much more NFL in the future, and there'll be futures pieces and win totals, as well as with the NCAA. And you did put out your first Big Ten futures piece. Sorry, your Big Ten win totals piece. We've had some futures pieces out there. Just want to get your quick thoughts on Big Ten SEC win totals. I know you released two in that Big Ten piece, and you're pretty high on the Big Ten, right?
Yeah, I love the Big Ten this year. So I'm reading a lot of respected journalists, and I don't want to diss people that I respect on Twitter, but a lot of highest respected journalists that don't gamble. I could tell they don't gamble. They're making their top 25s, and they've got five Big Ten teams like in the top seven or the top eight. I mean, that's how, and the perception is real. I mean, don't get me wrong. The conference is loaded. There's four teams from one division that deserve all the mention, and there's Wisconsin on the other side that deserves all the mention. They are much stronger at the top and in the middle. They can compete with the SEC. The SEC is completely top heavy. There's essentially two legitimate teams, one that's trying to be with Auburn. And then after that, it just completely falls off the back. It's kind of a dumpster fire at every other program. Hopefully Mullen gets Florida back up, in that talk in a couple of years. It's not going to happen overnight, but their programs like Arkansas, Tennessee, and LSU's quickly on their way to the dumpster fire, to the back of the line in that league.
And all right, before I get to a potential side bet with you, I loved actually both of the futures, the win totals that you gave out in the Big Ten piece. What was your favorite? Speak to your favorite one of the two and why.
Northwestern by far. So Northwestern was the biggest overplay I had last year. And a lot of it was on what they returned, about Fitzgerald, about how, you know, he's when he gets these guys, he's got the squad for, you know, a number of years. They know his system, and he had the perfect schedule last year. They avoided a lot of the heat that came out of the East Division. It's the exact opposite this year. Northwestern's schedule, they have four games they absolutely cannot win. They have four games that are absolute coin tosses, and their total is 7.5. So, I mean, they're not going to beat Ohio State. They're not going to beat Michigan State. They're not going to beat Penn State. So if you already think that their ceiling is at 8 and the total is 7.5, and then they got four other coin flip games against the Iowas of the world and the Wisconsins, there's just no way that they're going to get over 7.5. So that under 7.5 on Northwestern. Plus, they have to replace almost everybody on the team. Their quarterback, Thorson, he's still dealing with an ACL issue. We don't even know if he's going to start this season. That's 7.5 on Northwestern. That deserves a lot of investment on the under.
All right. Under on Pat's Cats. Heard it here first. I'm with you there. And also on PSU, if you read the piece. So, okay, before we sign off here, I want to, and we'll finish up with the Derby, but I want to have a side bet here. You're so high on the Big Ten. This is something we'll try and do on every podcast and with a side bet. What kind of odds do you want where if you take the Big Ten and I take the field to win the national title?
Not to self-promote myself, but I cut a nice little audio last night that will be produced and put up on the Action Network tomorrow. And it's for a team that I'm backing to not only make the playoff, but to also win the national championship. And it's neither SEC nor is it Big Ten. But I will say this, if you want to switch this bet over, I would take the Big Ten over the SEC. So if you want to make a side bet on this, if you want to just say randomly that I get one team that goes farther than any SEC team, I'll take it. Because I think either after what happened last year with two SEC teams getting into the playoff, I think the Big Ten is the one that's got the resume to put two teams into the playoff this year. Someone's coming out of there 11-1, not playing in the championship game, and with Ohio State being left out as a conference champ at two losses, there's just going to be enough whining and bitching down there with that committee that somebody that's 11-1 is going to get in from the Big Ten.
All right, well, let's do this. On each one of these podcasts, we'll do a $500 side bet. $500, I take the SEC to win it all. You take the Big Ten, even money. If another team from another conference wins, it's a wash.
Yeah, we'll take it.
All right, deal has been made. The first official DeGen and Juice side bet. And then before we sign off here, Derby, Laduca, put out a great piece today, and we'll have that covered the rest of the week going over the field. I haven't really, you know, spent a lot of time on it. I can tell you that the one that I had my eye on was Good Magic, but I still have a lot of work to do. Do you have a early lean?
Yeah, I'm going with Magnum Moon. It's my Arkansas Derby winner at Oaklawn.
Of course.
But I mean, you know, that the Magnum Moon has a 16 position. That's a good position. That's has frequently had some wins. So is the number 5 pole position. That's audible at 8-1. My long shot bet that's going to get on some of my my supers boxes is going to be my boy Jack. And the reason is I'm watching the weather. Now, there's supposed to be some rain on Friday night, and if that gets pushed over into Saturday and there's a muddy track, do your research on my boy Jack, because he is tremendous in the mud and knows how to get to the rail and just take it home.
Capping the mudders. Okay, so, yeah, keep an eye on the weather. That's always important. Thanks for joining me, Colin, and shout out again to Matt Moore for joining us. We should be back in about 2 weeks or so, every week and a half, 2 weeks. We'll do these up until football season, then we'll get back to the regularly scheduled weekly podcast with the same format as last year, recapping the week that was, looking ahead. Hopefully we can have another successful college football year. So we'll catch you all in a couple weeks. Thanks for joining me, Colin. Cheers.
Peace out. Some sequins gin. Everybody got their cups, but they ain't chipped in.